This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is our week in review program. There's a lot happening. We've been on high alert, collecting all of the most important news to help you out and help you make sense of what's happening in this world. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff. Brent Noctegal is here.
Hello.
Richard Palmer is via Skype from our office in the UK.
Good afternoon.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
And Robert Morley.
Hi there.
Our lead story today is the Pope's travels this coming week. He's going to be visiting Cuba starting tomorrow, and he'll be there for a few days before he moves to the U.S. on Tuesday. I think it's very interesting and very telling that before making his first trip to the United States, he's visiting Cuba. Trumpet readers will recall an article that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, wrote back in our March issue earlier this year called The Deadly, Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal. And the subhead of this article is the Roman Catholic Church trying to establish a strategic foothold 90 miles from American soil? If so, why? This really was a powerful article. The U.S. has been at odds with Cuba for 53 years, and suddenly President Obama decides last December that we're going to restore diplomatic ties. Now, this deal didn't require anything from Cuba. There were no concessions, nothing demanding that it change its dictatorial practices, no pressure on the criminal Castro regime. It actually strengthened that regime as they trample people's freedoms, as they allow drug trafficking and terrorism. And as that article brings out, the Vatican played a huge role in that move. Pope Francis pushed for this reconciliation. He wrote personal letters to President Obama and Raul Castro, and he hosted a secret meeting between the two sides in Rome. Now, the Catholic Church has a long history with Cuba, going back to Christopher Columbus in 1492, who claimed Cuba for Spain, which was obviously dominated by Catholicism. Pope Alexander VI, he commanded Spain to conquer, to colonize, and Catholicize the people of Cuba and the rest of the New World. And soon after that, Spain became part of the Habsburg Empire, which was part of the fourth resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire under Charles V. I want to just read a quote from this article by Gerald Fleury. By the end of the 1500s, Spain had become the richest country in the world. Much of this wealth and power came from Spain's conquest of the New World. Fleets of ships laden with billions of dollars in gold and silver crossed the Atlantic, and Cuba played a vital role in its wealth. Havana, Cuba, was the primary port for shipping all the treasures Spain was confiscating and mining in the New World. Ships ferried tens of thousands of tons of silver and gold from North and South America to Havana and from Havana to Seville, Spain. There, the Spanish spent it on the Habsburg struggle against the Ottoman Empire and its war with the major European powers of the day. It also helped to finance the Catholic Church's inquisitions as that church tried to extinguish all other religions in Europe. For many years, not a single European power was strong enough to stop the mighty and wealthy Holy Roman Empire and its ambition to colonize and Catholicize the New World. This is part of Cuba's heritage. We think of Cuba as communist, but really it's only been communist for about 50 years. It's been a Catholic country for almost 500 years. 60 to 65% of Cubans say they're Catholic, so there's obviously still a strong Catholic influence there. Well, what's going to happen in this country? What's going to happen? The Castros are very old. They're not necessarily going to be in power much longer. The Trumpet's free news report, the Trumpet Weekly, talks about this in today's edition. The cover story is the Francis Revolution. It's by Trumpet writer Callum Wood. And you can also find that. It's the top story right now on thetrumpet.com. It discusses the comments that Pope Francis has made condemning America and condemning the American economic model. He has called free market capitalism a financial system which rules rather than serves, and he's called it a new tyranny. He called American-style capitalism a subtle dictatorship. This is even while he's propping up and strengthening the actual dictatorship of the Castro regime. He's visiting this communist country. He's speaking at Havana's Plaza de la Revolución. It's in front of this massive 118-foot depiction of Argentinian Marxist revolutionary Che Guevara. What is this about? Well, this article by Callum Wood has a few statements that I'd like to read to you. The first is by Paul Farrell from Market Watch. He says, you put this, what the Pope is doing here in Cuba, together with everything else he has said, and he is obviously inciting revolution. He wants civil disobedience and political insurrection, and he's egging the poor into rebellion against a vastly outnumbered rich. Here's another quote from this article. Francis has attributed the plight of millions in Latin America to the greed of capitalism. In his recent trip to Bolivia, Pope Francis called capitalism the dung of the devil. The words are being well received by the poorer classes of Latin America, and why not? The Pope is giving the masses a cause to rally against, saying that wealth and opportunity will be the prize for success against American capitalism. There's an article in Time magazine by Christopher Hale that discusses the Pope's revolutionary ideas. He says, if it wasn't clear before, it is now. Pope Francis is no moderate. In what some are calling a nearly revolutionary speech, Francis gave a 55-minute papal tour de force in Bolivia, calling for structural changes to a global economy that runs counter to the plan of Jesus. That's a quote from the Pope there at the end. Mr. Wood continues, the Pope is revolutionizing Latin America against the United States. It is much more than a call to arms for the rebel-hearted. Pope Francis is making it a religious obligation to tear down capitalism and the nations that perpetuate it. During his fiery speech in Bolivia this July, Francis proclaimed, let us not be afraid to say it. We want change, real change, structural change. His speech was preceded by Bolivian President Evo Morales, who sported a jacket adorned with the face of Che Guevara. The president gave the Pope a wooden hammer and sickle, the symbol of communism, with a figure of a crucified Christ resting on the hammer. This is pretty interesting stuff that's going on here. Quite a bold attack against America. Already, the Pope is making these moves. And here on this visit, he travels to communist Cuba before coming to the United States. And when he visits the United States, well, what's going to happen? He's going to be praised. He's going to be adored and worshipped by millions of Americans who view him as a man of peace. They're not really asking questions. They're not looking at the big picture or asking themselves, what is he really about? Look at where Cuba is located, 90 miles off the coast of the United States. Let me just read a little bit more from this article by Gerald Flurry. Many do not think the Caribbean is strategically important, but that's because the United States has dominated it for many decades. For the Catholic Spanish Empire, Cuba was the single strategic port that served two entire continents. For Napoleon, Haiti served as the basis of his empire in the New World. When he lost Haiti in a slave revolt, he gave up his ambitions in the Western Hemisphere and sold off a massive chunk of territory in Louisiana Purchase. Look at what the Soviets tried to do in 1962. They tried to deploy nuclear missiles to Cuba. They were trying to get a foothold to attack America right on America's doorstep, and they came dangerously close to doing so. So you can be sure anyone who wants to hurt America, take America down, is still eyeing Cuba as tremendously valuable strategic territory. It's like this huge aircraft carrier just sitting right there, and it can't be sunk. Here's a quote from Stratfor's George Friedman. He said this in December 23rd, 2014. After the Soviet Union tried to deploy intermediate-range ballistic missiles there, a new layer was created in which Cuba was a potential threat to the American mainland as well as to trade routes. This is something we really need to watch because the Bible prophesies that the U.S. is going to be economically besieged, and Cuba could play a huge role in that. The U.S. is also prophesied to be attacked, and it's prophesied to be betrayed. I strongly encourage you to go back and read this article by Gerald Flurry, The Deadly Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal. It shows how Cuba could play a significant role in the fulfillment of these prophecies. Already, Cuba has reportedly agreed to reopen a Soviet-era espionage facility in Cuba, which is a massive listening post for intercepting communications. Today, nobody sees the Vatican, nobody sees Europe as posing any kind of threat to the United States. We're looking at ISIS, we're looking at Iran and China and Russia, and those definitely are threats and they are concerning. But that's where biblical prophecy is so valuable, because it puts those threats in their larger context. And if you know biblical prophecy, you know that that old Holy Roman Empire is being resurrected again, that church-state combine ruled by the Vatican. And prophecy shows that it actually does pose the most serious threat there is for the United States. One final quote from Gerald Flurry: the German-led European Union is the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, that same Holy Roman Empire which centuries ago used Cuba so powerfully to fuel its wars. If the present resurrection were to move into Cuba again, it would be well positioned to make these kinds of attacks happen. The advantage is that it could do it in the cloak of secrecy, since Cuba is essentially a police state with tight controls on information. Think of the control that it could have. Think of how valuable Cuba has been to America's enemies in the past. You need to watch what is happening in Cuba. Go to thetrumpet.com, read Callum Wood's article, The Francis Revolution, and search for and read Gerald Flurry's article, The Deadly Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal. It really puts Pope Francis's visit to Cuba and the United States this week into its prophetic perspective. That is our top story. We're going to turn now to the Middle East, and we'll begin with an overview of headlines from this past week. We'll turn to Brent.
Well, just the one thing I'd like to talk about at the top here is Russia's moves in Syria again. It looks like more satellite imagery came out this week about how Russia is building up an Air Force base or an airfield just off the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. They have at least half a dozen tanks and transports, so four different helicopters, a couple of attack helicopters, and also transport helicopters. They have large airplanes there, cargo airplanes, military airplanes, to transport a lot more hardware into the area. And they're even upgrading this airport as well. You can see that they haven't had any new airstrips, but a lot of different areas have been paved around for looking like they're going to station different weapons, different hardware. They also have artillery batteries set up as well in case mortars, in case this airbase is attacked. So it looks like they are getting more entrenched there. There is another report that the Russians were, at least a couple hundred of them, were seen in Hama, which is about 50 miles off the coast of the Mediterranean towards the east. And this is right on the area which ISIS has pushed up against. So they've gone to the front lines of the battle against ISIS in support of the Syrian regime. Now, they weren't fighting. These Russians, apparently, they stayed in a hotel there, and it looked like they were gathering intelligence. But they are scoping out what's going on in the fight against ISIS. And particularly this area where they were is important, because this area of Hama connects Damascus to the Mediterranean coast. So this is an area that Syria would want to ensure that they maintain, and the Russians are there looking like they're going to help them do that.
Thank you for that update. Your top story from the Middle East this week.
The top story today is about the violence that is escalating in Jerusalem. If you've watched any news this week, you probably would have seen the police maybe storming the Temple Mount, Israeli police, and rock throwing and such. But there is an article in the Trumpet Weekly that is very important to read, because it puts what's happening, this uptick, in perspective. We actually put this one in this morning. It's called The Temple Mount Violence Escalates. It's from El Monitor, and it's written by Ben Caspit. Now, Ben Caspit, as a journalist, he writes for El Monitor, which is an Arab news source generally, or follows the news in the Middle East, and mainly has a slant that is against Israel. He is kind of a left-winger. Benjamin Netanyahu has refused to give him interviews, the prime minister, because of his because of his left-wing stance. And yet what he writes in this article is a very balanced, I think, approach to the difficulty that anybody is going to have in putting down the flames of violence that are now engulfing Jerusalem. Now, it started, people would be familiar that Rosh Hashanah happened this week, the Feast of Trumpets, and this is a big time for Israelis. They flock to Jerusalem, or Jews around the world flock to Jerusalem to celebrate this. And it was this week that you had violence increase on the Temple Mount. On the eve of Rosh Hashanah, you had rocks being thrown against vehicles, Israeli vehicles, in the West Bank, and that caused a driver to crash and was killed. Then the next day, you had a pipe bomb being found, being smuggled into the Temple Mount by Israeli police. So it looked like they thought that the young Palestinians were going to try and incite some violence there against all these visitors that are flocking into Jerusalem. Now, we've written a lot about how Jerusalem is the thermometer of world events, and how when Jerusalem does increase or the violence increases there, that you need to pay attention to the whole world being spurred on by that. It's definitely one of the chief motivators of the Arab world. You look at what actually allowed the Arab League to get together back in the 60s. It was stuff that was taking place, or an attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Arabs couldn't get together in the 60s, and then somebody attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the next thing you know, the Arab League is set up. All these Arabs are going to come together and decide, well, we need to act against Israel. So it does have a very unifying force on the Arab world, whatever happens inside Jerusalem. Now, more of the events on the Temple Mount, what's taken place the 3 days following that, after the Israelis stormed the Temple Mount, you had rocks and Molotov cocktails and fireworks being fired at police. And you also had rocks being thrown just over the wall of the Temple Mount at the Western Wall, where all the Jews are praying, which is completely dangerous, of course. And so what you've seen commentators, and Ben Caspit is one of them that are saying this, is that you've got all these, the frenzy being whipped up here between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and nobody knows how to stop it. The Palestinian leadership, Mahmoud Abbas, he can't stop it. The Israelis are trying to stop it. They've announced this week, after some emergency meetings, that they're going to have harsher penalties for rock throwers. Maybe even, rock throwing is now counted as you can kill somebody through it. So maybe they need to take at least a sniper action. That's what they were saying. So you have this escalating scene in Jerusalem, and it does bear our attention and our vigilance. Now, obviously, somebody is fanning the flames. Obviously, somebody wants a uprising to take place inside Jerusalem. And I believe the Arabs are generally the cause of this, and particularly probably Hamas. Hamas has come out and said the Palestinian Authority, they are not doing enough to fight against Israel, are not doing enough to protect Al-Aqsa Mosque from the Israeli rampage. So they have said that they want to get rid of the Palestinian Authority for the leadership of the Arabs. And we know if Hamas gets, and there does look like there is some evidence leading to Hamas actually being the ones that have stationed these agitators on the Temple Mount so that they can provoke the Israelis into action. Now, the news reports you hear about this, you do have to be extremely cautious in what you believe and what you watch and what you see, because it will be painted as Israeli aggression. But the logic of it is, if the Arabs weren't throwing stones, or just if they were worshipping inside Al-Aqsa Mosque by themselves, not planning to attack, the Israelis are, they wouldn't storm the compound. That's just the reality of it. So you just need to watch that. But the broader trend is something that's more important. Jerusalem, again, is the thermometer of the world. It's the most volatile region in the whole world. And what's the most volatile region of Jerusalem? It is the Temple Mount. It is the old city of Jerusalem. And when that upticks, then we're watching for prophecy to unfold.
Just give us an idea of what the prophecy is that we're so, why we are so focused on Jerusalem and what we expect to happen. At some point, that really does serve as a trigger for a whole sequence of events.
Right. There is a prophecy in Zechariah that really does detail a couple of events that lead to the return of Jesus Christ. And the one that kicks that off, the dominoes falling, is half of Jerusalem being taken by the Arabs. Right now, we have half of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. It's being run by the Arabs, generally. Israeli have maintained sovereignty over it, but a lot of the East Jerusalemites, you know, it's Arab, the Arab population. So we are looking for a violent takeover or a violent ousting of Israeli forces from at least East Jerusalem, half of Jerusalem falling. So when we see tensions like this, we know that that event's kind of close.
Yeah, it's every time this kind of thing crops up, we have to go back and look at that. It's detailed in quite extensively in our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy, also written by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. That's another booklet that you can find on thetrumpet.com. It gives really a wonderful overview of what to look for in that region of the world. You can check that out on thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Brent, for that report. We're going to turn now to Europe and Richard. Richard, can you give us the overview of headlines from Europe from this past week?
Well, first, the immigration crisis update. Germany, they've been so pro-immigration, they closed their borders at the start of this week. And they said that's just a temporary measure. They said they just needed to catch their breath for a week or two. But it's triggered this whole domino of border closures all across Europe. Austria closed theirs, and a whole bunch of other Eastern European countries have closed theirs. Hungary especially was especially aggressive in shutting its borders. And now the immigrants can't get into Hungary, so they're trying to get from Serbia into Croatia and then from there up to Europe. But that's left a lot of pockets of immigrants kind of trapped in countries that don't have the facilities to deal with them. Related to that, there have been reports from Germany this week of extremist Muslims deliberately targeting the new arrivals and spreading pamphlets to their colleagues about how best to approach immigrants that have just come in from Syria and convince them to become terrorists. Moving on from immigration, Sweden and Poland signed a military cooperation pact this week. And one of the quotes from one of the leaders signing that pact, they said, "Once a sea of peace, the Baltic has become a sea of danger." So we're seeing more EU nations or European nations push militarily closer together by Russia's aggression. And we'll talk a bit more about that later. And then finally, Britain's Labour Party, this is the UK's equivalent of the Democrats, elected their new leader on Saturday. His name is Jeremy Corbyn, and he is an extreme left radical, an out-and-out socialist, if not a communist. And I really wanted to talk about him as my top story this week, but Mr. McDonald stole it from me and covered him pretty comprehensively in his Trumpet Daily Radio segment yesterday. So please, if you haven't heard that, go back and listen to that. But I'll just say this. He refused to sing the national anthem at a memorial event for those that died in the Battle of Britain earlier this week. That's how against his own country he is. And he was just voted as the main left-wing party's candidate for prime minister, and he won't sing his own national anthem. That paints a really worrying picture about the state of the whole of the UK.
All right, thank you very much. And now your top story from Europe this week.
My top story is that Angela Merkel is reportedly saying she'll offer the UK a looser relationship with the European Union in exchange for Britain allowing the rest of the EU to form its own military. And the Telegraph had an article on this with anonymous sources from within the German government, as well as an unpublished defense policy paper from Angela Merkel's party. And so just to read some quotes from that, their anonymous source said that if Cameron wants a flexible Europe, he must let the other members integrate further. Yes, fine, opt out, opt out, opt out, and then shut up. And then the paper said that it is urgent to integrate the armed forces in the face of multifaceted crises. It calls for a permanent, structured, and coordinated cooperation of national armed forces in the medium term. In the long run, this process should, according to the present German coalition agreement, lead also to a European army. Those are from their anonymous or less reputable sources, so we can't be so sure on those. But there are a lot of things that we do know absolutely for certain that back up what the Telegraph is reporting here. We know that Germany has long wanted an EU army, as that quote just demonstrated. It's in their latest coalition agreement. It is one of the official published goals of this German government. And this ambition for a European army goes way beyond Germany. EU President Jean-Claude Juncker is pushing it. EU think tanks are pushing it. Here's a quote from one of Juncker's top assistants who wrote this paper for a think tank. It says, "The UK does not share an interest in a closely integrated European defence, whereas Germany, France, together with the Benelux countries, Italy, Spain, and more recently Poland, are more open to the idea. And it said, clearly, security in Europe is today high in demand and low in supply, begging the question, if not now, when? So there's a lot of support for a European army far beyond just Germany. And there are a lot of natural obstacles that have to be overcome in creating an armed force. It means persuading European countries to give up at least part of their army, which means part of their sovereignty, to a European army. But a lot of that has already been overcome, especially by Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. And so now it's no exaggeration to say that the biggest obstacle to an EU army is the United Kingdom. A lot of those other substantial barriers towards that have been overcome. And the second thing that we kind of know for sure, whether or not these Telegraph's claims are true, is that we do know that there is a lot of support in Europe for this idea of Britain being allowed to move away from the EU in exchange for allowing the other nations to unite. So just this week, Mr. Juncker made a public statement making this case, and he talked about the looser relationship Britain wanted and said, he said, to be fair to the other member states, the UK's choices must not prevent them from further integration where they see fit. And then the Telegraph summarized some more of what he said, saying that Mr. Juncker proposed a powerful EU institutions that Britain would not be obliged to join, including a Eurozone treasury, a border and coast guard, a green card system of legal migration, a new draft of laws relating to pay and conditions. So this is something far beyond an EU army. The EU army is just one facet of this. Britain would be allowed to go its own way in exchange for not stopping Europe coming together into this superstate-like structure.
It's interesting, this development, because there's so many aspects of this that we've been tracing as it's been coming closer to fruition. The effort to build a European army and all of the workarounds that we've seen, especially with Germany making bilateral agreements with other European countries. And if you could just give me a better sense of how it is that Britain is the obstacle. Like I guess the other aspect of it is just Europe kind of saying, look, we want to do our own thing, and Britain is just kind of hanging up all of our ambitions to unify within Europe. I just wonder, how is it that Angela Merkel essentially views Britain as the primary obstacle to the creation of a European army?
Well, there's the fact that if one EU nation is against something, then it's not hugely difficult for them to form a blocking minority. So a lot of big changes require things like two-thirds judgments. Then there's things that nations can do in the courts and things to slow things down. So there are very practical things that Britain could do to stand in the way. However, there's also just a case of precedent. So there are ways that the EU could move forward for this army under the Lisbon Treaty. And there are ways that they could move forward with this and that Britain wouldn't have to be a part of it, but they wouldn't be able to block it either. But as the Telegraph points out, European leaders have been reluctant to push forward with this, partly because they don't want to have a split with Britain, because Britain and France are by far the top two military spenders of the European Union. So they don't want one of the most powerful militaries in Europe to be an implacable opponent of this. What they would like to do is move forward with this combined European army and remain on friendly terms with Britain and the British army, and be able to count on the British army as an ally at the same time. So they'd like to move forward on this with Britain's blessing rather than over Britain's dead body.
Hey, Richard, if I could just interject something. It seems like this might be a case of Germany calling Britain's bluff a little bit on this. I just wonder what your thoughts are historically on Britain and Britain not liking the idea of having, you know, an army on the continent that could threaten it historically.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And for example, this article for The Telegraph quotes a conservative MEP, Geoffrey Van Orden. He's a retired British Army brigadier. And he says that allowing a European army is too high a price to pay for Britain's renegotiation. Well, and I think your point is absolutely right, but I don't think Britain's leaders think that way. If you look at some of the comments people like Mr. Cameron and George Osborne made during the Eurozone crisis, they were very keen on the rest of Europe coming together and forming the kind of common government necessary to solve this crisis. So I think you're right, And I think there are people within the Conservative Party that see it that way. But I think the leaders don't have the kind of historical depth that would lead them to draw that conclusion.
Just one more really strong example of the friction between Britain's interests and Europe's interests, and the way that European leaders are going about pursuing this integration project, and just how much that puts them at odds with Britain and its own national interests. Thank you, Richard, for that report. These articles that we're discussing are in this week's Trumpet Weekly. It's an informative report that we produce each week with the most significant stories from around the world. I encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. Go online to thetrumpet.com and become a Trumpet Weekly subscriber. Coming up next, we'll look at the important news from Asia and America, and later on in the program, our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week. We're going to turn now to Jeremiah Jacques with the overview from Asia.
Sure. Russia is continuing to cut financial and economic ties with the West. We published a piece this week by Stratfor showing that Russia is working to pass measures that would prohibit Russian companies from using foreign currency. It would prohibit foreign loans to Russian firms, and several other moves that would cut Russian ties to the West. And some analysts are calling these proposals a return to the Soviet Union. Stratfor says that the measures also signal that Russia is willing to weather the current hardships rather than bend to the United States. Another story this week covers China's increasingly aggressive foreign policy. This is a piece published by The Hill on Wednesday, and it's called "Will China Follow Putin's Lead?" It does a great job of just drawing the parallels between Vladimir Putin's Russia and Xi Jinping's China. And it shows that China has learned some valuable lessons from Russia's example. China has learned that this is a golden age for expansionism. It has learned that the U.S.'s will to use its military might is broken. And it has learned that it's a good time to push against the status quo and to try to close the curtain on the era that you might call Pax Americana.
More alignment between China and Russia. Your top story from Asia this week.
Yeah, the top story is about Russia's Middle East strategy. In the past few weeks, and even earlier in this program, we've talked a lot about Russia's increasing military involvement there in Syria, and that remains keenly relevant, but it's actually just one part of a larger strategy that Russia is carrying out in the Middle East. It's important to know some of the history there. At one point during the Cold War, the Soviet Union actually fought against the Israelis on behalf of the Egyptians. And that was in order to protect the Soviet Union's allies in Egypt, with the long-term goal of boosting Soviet Union power in the Middle East. And as a result of that, the Soviets really did come to wield quite a lot of influence throughout the Middle East during that Cold War era. Well, all of that drastically changed in the early 90s when the Soviet Union collapsed. And then the United States became really the only extra-regional player to wield any sort of significant power in the Middle East. But now we see Russia following that old Soviet pattern, working to regain its lost influence in the Middle East, and it is having quite a lot of success toward that end. In Iran, Moscow is building relations with both the moderates and the hardliners. Russia played a key role in the nuclear deal that we've discussed several times. And Russia is tightening its ties with Iran through cooperation against the Islamic State terrorists also. And then in Syria, as we've discussed, it's really been Russia, along with Iran, that have kept Assad's regime afloat. They've conducted airlifts and sea lifts of ammunitions and supplies. They've also used a lot of diplomacy to keep Assad's regime afloat by pressuring Western powers not to take any action against his murderous regime. And then Moscow is also building deeply significant relationships with Egypt, with Jordan, with Saudi Arabia, with the Gulf states, and just establishing cooperation on a whole range of issues. In June, the Saudi crown prince visited Moscow, and then the king of Jordan visited the next month, and the president of Egypt, and then the crown prince of Abu Dhabi came to discuss, I think it was a nuclear energy deal.
Then the coming up in the next few months, the Emir of Kuwait and the King of Saudi Arabia have plans to visit. And so it's a lot of really important developments there. And another very important thing that we don't hear that much about is the role of the Russian Orthodox Church in the Middle East. The Russian Orthodox Church has been very active, and it enables Russia to promote itself globally as the only patron of persecuted Christians in the Middle East. Other powers may give, you know, token support to the Christians. They may speak out against it. But the Russian Orthodox Church has been the main real protector of that. And Russia misses no chance to really play up the involvement of its church there.
What sort of activities is it taking besides the speeches?
Well, I think a lot of it is rhetorical still at this point, but there have been some moves toward allowing refugees to come into Russia as long as they're Christian from Syria and things like that. It's still just a handful of people at this point, but it is it's something that Russia may play it up a little more than what their actual involvement is. But it seems like something that a lot of analysts have called attention to.
So you may have said this a little bit, but if you could elaborate a little bit more on what exactly Russia's interests are in the Middle East, why it has such a determination to establish a presence there.
Sure, yeah. The article that we publish in the Trumpet Weekly talks about five main goals that Russia has there. One is to build a buffer against radical jihadists on its southern flank. Another is just to export arms and nuclear energy, just, you know, purely economic. And then there's also just wanting to project power into the Middle East, into its warm waters there in the Mediterranean and beyond. And then probably the biggest one is to compete with the West. It's just a desire to say there's, you know, this era of unipolarity, this era when the United States is the only superpower, that era is over. That's a big one. And then the last one is just to expand influence among and through regional Christian communities.
So it is interesting how, looking at this, say, from a prophetic perspective, because we really focus more on the presence of Europe in the Middle East and its designs on that particular territory. And I guess you could view it in the context, like we have talked about the last couple of weeks with Russia's presence increasing in Syria, that this is something of a proxy war. It's something of a battleground that is kind of playing out really between Europe and Russia, in a sense, even though it's happening in the Middle East. Is that the primary sort of prophetic angle that we would view this through?
I believe so. It's complicated because we don't know a lot about, from a biblical standpoint, it's more difficult to see the significance of Russian involvement in the Middle East. But we do know that when the king of the north, when Europe enters into the Middle East, it says that he'll take out Iran. But then it also says the Egyptians and Ethiopians will be at his steps. And I wonder if some of that may have to do with the fact that Egypt is becoming a very solid Russian ally at this point. So maybe part of the reason why the Egyptians are taken out by Europe is because of their alignment with Egypt. So really we do see a deepening divide between East and West, and it's happening there in the Middle East pretty starkly.
Well, if nothing else, Russia's increased involvement in that region would amplify the threat that Europe perceives from Russia, and to just recognize this is all the more reason why we need to step up and to take care of this. We've talked a lot about just how much Russian aggression is catalyzing European unification and militarization, and this is probably a really strong example of why that would be the case. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. We're going to go now to Anglo-America. For that, we'll turn to Robert, beginning with the overview.
Sure. Only four or five U.S.-trained Syrian rebels remain on the battlefield to take on the Islamic State, a senior Defense Department reported.
Wait. You said four or five?
Four or five. So if you remember back to last year when the White House pushed Congress to allocate $500 million for training up to almost 5,000 fighters. Well, a year later, here we are. We found out that, yeah, they actually had trained up about 60 at one point, but those guys were either wiped out or had fled the battlefield, and we're down to the senior department official saying, yeah, we think we have four or five that are left fighting. But don't worry, we're still working on training. We have another 100 or so in the pipeline that are going through the process. So a lot of leaders are looking at this and saying it's just been a total failure so far.
$500 million not well spent.
$500 million, 41 of that million gone so far, and we have five fighters in the field.
Okay.
Okay, moving on. The Census Bureau, it's reporting that the wallets of Americans, middle class and the poorest in America, aren't seeing any extra money again this year. They said that both the median income and the poverty rate were statistically unchanged this year. And that's important because there's still almost 47 million people, according to the Census Bureau, living in poverty in the United States. To give you an idea of what that means for a family of four, that's with a family income of $24,000 or less. So if you want to know why so many people are feeling unhappy in this country, it gets back to the fact that incomes have been declining in the United States since at least 1999. So we're going on dozens of years here where family incomes are falling.
So last week, your top story was about how the World Bank officials were warning the Federal Reserve that if it raised interest rates, it would cause panic and turmoil. This week, the Fed said, we're not going to raise rates. Your top story is why?
Right, exactly. So the Federal Reserve announced yesterday that it would hold steady on its interest rate. And if you recall, its interest rate for the last 7 years has been stuck between a very low 0% and 0.25%. Nothing like this has ever happened in the history of the United States. And the Fed had been telegraphing for a while that this can't stay like this forever. And a lot of financial authorities have been warning, if you don't start raising rates, this is going to cause major problems later. The Bank for International Settlements, for example, issued a month ago, we talked about that, just a scathing critique of global monetary policy, including the Fed, and saying, if we don't get interest rates up pretty soon, when the next recession hits, we'll have nothing left to combat that. So the Fed has been saying, well, as soon as the economy gets strong enough to handle it, we'll increase rates. Well, here, once again, they came out and said, we're looking at things and we don't feel that it's ready yet to raise interest rates. And this didn't make markets very happy. It sent the signal that, okay, the economy maybe isn't as strong as we thought it was because the Fed doesn't raise rates. But I think even bigger than that, the markets are just so addicted to debt that having, you know, that just leaving rates unchanged isn't good enough anymore. They need more debt. They need lower rates to keep things up. They need, you know, a bigger shot of adrenaline, more drugs into the system to keep markets going. So markets were down yesterday on the news. Just slightly flat to down. This morning they were down even bigger than they were yesterday.
It makes you wonder what they would have done had the Fed actually raised the rates.
It sure does. I think they would have thrown a tantrum, and then we would have seen the resolve of the Fed. Are they willing to do what's needed to rebalance the economy and get it back to where it can actually, you know, grow on its own? Good question.
It's lose-lose, but this was the course they took.
Yeah, well, absolutely. This the situation we're in right now was baked into the cake back in 2009 when they decided to not let the financial system rebalance, to kick the can down the road. We're going to slash interest rates to zero. We're going to make free money available to the big banks. We're going to do the quantitative easing, the four rounds. You remember quantitative easing one, QE2, QE, all these rounds of money printing, trillions of dollars into the system. Mm-hmm. But what happened because of that was, you know, the debts didn't get taken care of. Instead of bad debts getting written off, they just got rolled over into the system. All those bad debts are still there. There's now we have, you know, zombie companies in America. They're living, they're alive, but financially on paper, if interest rates go up, they're dead. They're dead men walking, and the markets realize this. So a lot of authorities are saying don't raise interest rates because you're going to cause a lot of problems. And that was what we talked about last week with the chief economist for the World Bank saying if you raise interest rates, it could cause panic and turmoil. And they're talking about interest rates of maybe an eighth of a point to a quarter of a point. So that's how unstable things are right now.
Zombie companies. Zombie. Never heard that before.
They're alive, but if interest rates go up, they could be dead.
Anything else that we ought to talk about with that? The question is why? What does it say that the Fed said we're not willing to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Fed is looking at America, our situation in America, and we've talked a lot about debt and how debt has just increased so dramatically. For example, federal debt's up 40% in America since the economic collapse in 2008. We were supposed to retrench, we're supposed to pay down the debt. That didn't happen. But the rest of the world is in just as bad shape. And a lot of these monetary authorities are saying, if you raise rates, you could set off problems around the rest of the world, which are going to come back and hit America. So the IMF, which is more Eurocentric, they focus more on European issues. Christine Lagarde, she came out last month and said, don't raise rates this year. If you raise rates this year, we're going to have trouble. And it's because so many of these nations around the world have borrowed dollars, and they've borrowed in dollars. They have debts that are denominated in dollars. And if we raise rates here, that starts to impact them dramatically. And if we were to raise rates here, it could temporarily cause the dollar to go up in value, and it'll be a lot harder for those nations to pay their debts. And they're saying, hey, we could have a repeat very quickly of what happened in 2008. And just to remind our listeners what 2008 was all about, go to our website. We have an article. It's the story from our editor and our latest Trumpet edition that's up on the website. And in it, he talks about how close the world came to having the global financial system end. And he talked about how Nancy Pelosi called Hank Paulson, who's a Treasury Secretary at the time, said, hey, can you brief Congress on Sunday or on Monday when you come in about this situation? He said, madam, if we don't do something about it today, you won't have a financial system on Monday. That's where we were at in 2008. And unfortunately, we haven't progressed from there. We're seeing when a quarter of a percent raise increase in interest rates can cause panic and turmoil. We know the problems haven't been solved.
The title of that article, How the Global Financial Crisis Will Produce Europe's 10 Kings, you can find that online at thetrumpet.com. You can also go there to receive a free subscription to our news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Robert, you wrote an article about this that's up on the website. People can find that on thetrumpet.com as well. We're going to finish up the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, beginning with Brent.
The headline of this story is Islamic State jihadis may be posing as Syrian refugees. That's what Lebanese minister, the education minister, told David Cameron, the prime minister of the UK, when he was down there in Lebanon on Monday. He said to watch out. He's got this gut feeling that the people flooding into Lebanon these days are different to the ones that came out at the start of the Syrian conflict. And they look a little bit different, and they're heading on their way up to through Syria and then back up to Turkey. And he said at least 2 out of every 100 could be extremists flooding into Europe. So there's a worry there.
Speaking of which, we'll go now to Richard for Europe.
I'd like to point to another event coming up next week. And that is that the UN is scheduled to open. The Pope will kick everything off on September 25th. And then there's a whole bunch of other speakers. And there are so many prophetic trends just in the UN's opening itinerary. So Federica Mogherini, the EU's foreign minister, is launching a new peace initiative for Israel. And we've long said to watch for Israel to get more involved in the peace process. And the new idea she's pushing is to get the Arab states involved in what's called the Quartet Plus negotiations. So it'd be kind of the permanent UN Security Council nations and the Arab states. And that's another trend we've highlighted, Europe's budding alliance with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Arab states. Then the UK will be leading the EU's push to conduct more military operations in Libya's waters against people traffickers. And again, we've talked quite a lot about Europe getting more involved in North Africa. During this opening, the Palestinian flag will fly outside the UN for the first time, a big increase in status for them and a defeat for Israel. And then finally, we get a good demonstration of why the UN can never bring peace. Vladimir Putin will be speaking for the first time there for the first time in 10 years. And this is the man who just invaded his neighboring state of Ukraine, and he'll be welcomed in with honors and giving a warm welcome. Robert Mugabe, a former terrorist leader and a murderous head of state who's devastated his country, will be speaking. And so will Omar al-Bashir, who is wanted for genocide by the International Criminal Court.
Quite a cast of characters there. All right, thank you for that, Richard. We'll turn now to Jeremiah.
The Japanese parliament yesterday broke into an intense brawl over legislation that would let the military play a more assertive role in global affairs. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has invested considerable political capital into attempts to pass this legislation. He and his government want Japan to become a full-fledged military power once again, and they've already made a lot of headway toward that end. The legislation this week would allow the Japanese military to cooperate more closely with the militaries of Japan's allies, like the United States. But not all Japanese politicians are on board, and some were literally fighting to keep this law from passing. I watched some of the video footage from this brawl that broke out, and it really looked like a rugby match was happening right there in the committee chamber. Politicians who don't want Japan's military to take on a greater role piled up on top of the committee chairman, pulled the microphone away from him, and they were just trying to prevent it from ever going to a vote. And then the lawmakers from Abe's party jumped in there. They formed kind of a scrum around the chairman, and that way they could call the vote. And the vote did end up passing. And so it said, yes, Japan's military will play a greater role in global affairs. But I think it's somewhat ironic that the politicians who want Japan to be a pacifist nation resorted to violence and force to try to get their way. But this is a big story. It's a historic shift that's underway there, and it's something that we will keep listeners apprised of as it develops.
The pacifists fought, but they weren't apparently as good of fighters as the others.
That's a good point.
All right, now to Robert.
The World Wildlife Federation is out with a new report, and it's absolutely startling. The World Wildlife Federation is a little bit lefty, so we have to take what they say with a grain of salt. But according to their report, they're saying that half of all marine life have been killed off during the last four decades due to pollution and industrial fishing techniques and climate change. And they say that specifically stocks of tuna and mackerel, for example, they've declined by 75% since 1970. They say that fish aren't the only marine organisms in decline. They're saying that the oceans in general are facing crisis. Large swaths of coral reef, mangroves, seagrasses have died off or been hacked away, and they're saying it's just decimating fish populations. The World Wildlife Federation says that there's hope, but time is running out, and we need to start taking action soon. And some scientists have said that the Earth may now be in what they're calling a mass extinction event, only this time they're saying that it's being caused largely by human activity. It just reminds me of a prophecy in Hosea that talks about the fish of the sea being taken away and the oceans losing their life like we're seeing today.
Well, I just wanted to conclude with drawing attention to an article that's in this week's Trumpet Weekly from the Wall Street Journal from last Sunday. It's called America's Legal Order Begins to Fray. It's talking about a trend that we've been following quite a lot over the last few months, or a couple of years, really. It says a virulent anti-police campaign over the past year, initially fueled by a since-discredited narrative about a police shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, has made police officers reluctant to do their jobs. It says, with police so discouraged, violent crime has surged in at least 35 American cities this year. We talked about that a few weeks ago. But it says that something more fundamental than even public safety may be at stake. There are signs that the legal order itself is breaking down in urban areas. A quote from a female sergeant in New York: there's a total lack of respect out there for the police. The perps feel more empowered to carry guns because they know that we are running scared. The police are running scared. It says the lawful use of police power is being met by hostility and violence, often ignored by the press. There are several examples here: people opening fire at police officers, crowds pelting cops with frozen water bottles and rocks, officers being challenged in their most basic efforts to render aid. There's one example of a New York cop in the Bronx who was trying to extricate a woman pinned under an overturned car when a bystander stuck his cell phone camera into the officer's face, trying to bait him into an argument. Supervisors they're talking about trash and other projectiles being thrown at officers and so on. This is a really significant trend in the United States. We've been talking about its significance in thetrumpet.com and how this relates to biblical prophecy. This article concludes, police officials I've spoken with in recent months say that they long to hear America's leaders change the tone of the national conversation before respect for the rule of law itself deteriorates further. They're still waiting. Yeah, they're still waiting. They're going to keep on waiting because you cannot expect this administration to back up any respect for the rule of law. It's doing exactly the opposite. Well, I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of another Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. The stories that we talked about on the program today are all in our free weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly, and you can become a subscriber of this report for free. Go to thetrumpet.com and go to the subscriptions tab, and you can receive this report each week in your email inbox. Please send us your comments or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. We're also on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com and on Facebook and Google Plus under Philadelphia Trumpet. That's the name of the news magazine. I want to thank the panel, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
You're welcome.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
And thanks to the technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Ben Franklin. I think the best way of doing good to the poor is not making them easy in poverty, but leading or driving them out of it. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.